Our next case is 21-2372, Dynex Softron GmbH versus Agilent Technologies, Inc. Mr. Spitzer, you've reserved 6 minutes of your time.
And your honors, thank you for having me back so quickly. May it please the court, representing...
Good to have you back.
Appellant Dynex. Unless the court has questions regarding priority, I propose not to address that issue in these remarks. The priority issues are essentially identical. What I would like to do instead, with the court's leave, is move straight to the question of standing. This arises only in the 2372 case. In that case, in the interference below, the 109 interference, Dynex moved for judgment on the grounds that Agilent could not support the claims of the involved Agilent application with the specification of the Agilent application. That motion rested upon a particular claim construction, focusing on the word determining, and the board rejected the Dynex claim construction, found that a broader claim construction was appropriate, and therefore denied Dynex's motion. Had the board accepted Dynex's claim construction, it seems indisputable that the result would have been a finding of lack of written description for the Agilent claims. The claims, therefore, not allowable. Agilent lacks standing and judgment for Dynex. So I'm going to focus on the claim construction issue alone. And of course, that's an issue that the court is readily familiar with. We start with the plain English, as with any claim construction issue. So there are two elements, and we have them numbered in the briefing. Element 3, which describes a step of determining a movement amount of the piston. And then a second element, element 5, that specifies decreasing the sample loop volume by advancing the piston by the determined amount. And in both instances, you see careful construction of an antecedent basis and then use of that antecedent basis. Claim element five uses the phrase the determined movement amount, clearly intending to refer back to the movement amount determined in element 3.
This case comes down to the meaning of the?
It comes down to the meaning, Your Honor, of determining, and in assisting us in understanding what determining means, we can look at...
My understanding is you believe that because it says the determined movement amount, referencing the earlier statement in the claim of determining a movement amount, that therefore the determining step has to occur before the forwarding the piston step, right?
Exactly.
And an alternative way to understand it is that by saying the determined movement amount, it's just trying to reference what had been stated earlier in the claim without actually demanding or suggesting that one particular step occur before the other. That's an alternative.
That's
that's what the board went with.
Yes. And what the board did not explain, though, is why that second use of the determined movement amount added anything to the claim. Indeed, if one accepts the board's interpretation that one can advance the piston by some amount unknown that creates a pressure that's sufficient to do the job, then the system has simultaneously both determined the movement amount and move the piston by the determined amount. And what the board didn't explain is why that second part of that language is required. Claim language, of course, claims are to be interpreted so as to give claim language meaning. And under the board's interpretation, element 5, moving the piston by the determined amount, becomes completely superfluous. We don't believe that any other interpretation of the claim than the one we have provided is consistent with the plain and ordinary meaning, the English on the page. But if we do want to go to the next step of construing the claim in light of the specification, the question arises, does the Agilent rule apply? And I'd like to remind the court that when Agilent filed the preliminary amendment that introduced these claims into the 402 application, the first sentence of the remarks reads, "The claims presented herein are substantially copied from U.S. patent number 15596738. That's the Dionics patent application. And that's found in the reference, in the appendix at 2591. The Agilent rule requires that claims be construed in light of the specification from which the claims originated. It is clear that the board erred in construing the Agilent claims in light of the Agilent specification when the claims clearly originated from the 738 application.
But what should we take from the fact that the board refused to order an interference between your earlier patent and this claim that was substantially copying the claim in your patent?
Well, bear in mind that the board was... I think we're talking about the interference branch of the examining level of the PTO, not the board itself. And so when you go through the file history of the 402 application, it lacks the submission requesting the declaration of an interference. Although Agilent included, as it is required to under Rule 56 and duty of candor, the statement that I just read, Agilent never then stated that it wished to prompt an interference. The case went to issuance, and at that point, the examiner said, but for the fact that these claims are substantially copied from the 738 application, the claims are allowable, I'm going to now refer the case to the examining, to the interference branch. That happened, and in the meantime, Dionics had filed an application that's the child of the 738 that exactly copied the now pending Agilent claims, and the interference that was declared was between that child application on Dionics' point, on Dionics' part, and the Agilent application. But neither party specifically asked for an interference to be declared. The interference only arose because the examiner said these allowed claims, or these patentable claims, would be allowable but for the interference issue. I'm referring this to the interference branch. So what do we make of that? Somewhere in the interference branch, somebody said rather than declare an interference between the 402 application and the issued 112 patent, which was now the state of the 738 application, I'm going to use this child application from the 738 application as the basis for the interference, and the interference was declared. We do not know why the record is silent on the point.
How would it make a difference which originating disclosure, which specification we viewed as the originating disclosure?
In the Dionics application, the only embodiment that shows a step of determining a movement amount and then moving the piston by that moving amount describes algorithms, lookup tables, and other techniques that are different from the feedback mechanism, which is the only mechanism that's described in the Agilent specification.
So you don't believe you have disclosure in the Dionics specification for essentially real-time embodiment where you determine it basically at the same time that you are doing it.
There is an embodiment in the Dionics application that does use a feedback loop, and it's virtually identical to the system, hence the interference, I suppose, that's disclosed in the Agilent application.
So why would that not be adequate, even if we took your view that we should look to the Dionics disclosure as the originating disclosure?
It isn't necessary to for a claim to cover every embodiment in the specification. There is an embodiment in the specification of the Dionics application that clearly requires determining the movement amount by a specified distance and then moving the piston that much. That is the embodiment to which these claims refer. A feedback mechanism would be phrased in very different language, and, for instance, you wouldn't need the second reference to moving the piston by that determined amount. Your Honors, if you have no further questions, I will reserve the balance of my time.
Okay, we thank you.
Morning again, Your Honors. John Scanga for Agilent. On the priority issue, I just want to mention briefly that there was a slightly expanded record in the second appeal. Some of these follow-up questions of the witnesses that never were asked by Dionics, we supplemented in the declaration to say that, yeah, now that you've pointed out some of these arguments, Dionics, that doesn't change any of our views. And that's in the Bowerly declaration at in the second appendix at 2194 and 2195. He discusses why he didn't need to see the hydraulics, why the plot was sufficient. Again, just further support for the arguments that we made and won on in the first appeal. Likewise, Mr. Kretz added to his declaration in the second appendix at 2155 through 59, again, refuting a number of the arguments that we've heard today. What is very interesting, again, these are questions that were never asked in the first depositions of the witnesses, and after submitting these slightly supplemented declarations in the second interference, no further depositions were sought. We think that's telling. I do want to mention the estoppel issue that hasn't been addressed, the interference estoppel issue based on the lost count and the prior art. The argument that was addressed for the first time in the gray briefs here was that this is an issue that should have been raised by Agilent in a cross appeal, as opposed to as an alternate ground for affirmance. And I just want to point out that we are seeking the same relief. We are seeking an affirmance of the same judgment, the judgment being that priority is not awarded to Dionics. So whatever the ground is, that would be the same judgment either way. And we think it's...
You're saying as a technical matter, if you're right on interference estoppel, that wouldn't lead to a vacature of the decision and an order to dismiss the interference?
Correct, Your Honor. It's essentially a ground of unpatentability that we raised at the board.
Yes, the question is, if interference estoppel in fact did apply, why would there be any kind of... wouldn't that moot out the priority dispute?
That's why we consider it to be an alternative ground. The board could have
gotten... The meeting would thereby deprive the board from the ability to render a decision on a priority.
No, Your Honor, I look at it differently from the point of view that, again, either argument would have led to the result that we are the party with priority, and whether it's essentially an unpatentability ground or a priority ground, we get to the same place. And we saw that there's two appeals here today. There was a prior appeal in May of 2020. Where it was a Section 112 written description issue, an unpatentability issue, and the board's judgment that was affirmed by the Federal Circuit there, same exact wording. The judgment is that priority is denied to Dionics, and the case that was raised by Dionics, the Hamilton Beach versus Ferreal case, is an example, Your Honor, where the alleged alternative ground would have caused the need for a vacature. There was an appeal from an IPR, and the Federal Circuit both affirmed the patentability decision on the merits of the final written decision, and the appellee said, well, you know, by the way, this, the patentee appellee said, by the way, the, uh, the IPR never should have been instituted in the first place. And not only did I win on the merits at the final written the decision stage, but it never should have been instituted in the first place. And this court said, well, that's a different relief. The relief would have been the proceeding never should have started in the first place. Whereas here, interference estoppel was raised by motion, the result being that, again, effectively a determination that the count would be unpatentable. So we're seeking the same relief, and therefore it's an alternate grounds. And part of the reason why we raised this, again, we're now third appeal after three interferences. These cases, patent families are still pending. There's no other pending interferences, but we'd certainly like to streamline any future proceedings if we have them. I'd like to turn now to the claim construction written description issue, unless there's any further questions. We believe that the board correctly construed the claim to not require a sequence of steps, to not require predetermining the movement amount, and that was the correct application of the general rule that sequence or order is not implied into method steps. And here, in connection with this determining limitation, there is no language associated with the timing or sequence, whereas we do see some sequential language with respect to some other steps. There's expressly a reference to while the sample loop is isolated in one of the limitations, so we're talking about doing something contemporaneously with the isolating step. We talk about moving from a first position to a second position, so we have a sequence there. But no similar language with respect to determining. Really what it comes down to is this antecedent basis reference to the determined movement. The determining was referenced earlier in the claim, and that is all we have. And it simply makes sense that the antecedent basis is respected. That doesn't make the entire limitation superfluous. If we look at the analysis from information, we look at logic and grammar, and here logically we know that the system works from a technological perspective if it is doing the determining in real time. We've got embodiments in both party specifications that do just that, so there's no question that it will work if it's construed the way we ask, which is that there's no time sequence implied. The experts agreed to the plain and ordinary meaning of determining as including making a real-time assessment. In fact, when we look at the grammar of the claim, the fact that we are ending up addressing the antecedent basis as thoroughly as it was in this disputed clause makes sense. Because the way the claim is written is steps are introduced. For example, isolating is introduced. And then a few subparagraphs later, there's yet another clause about isolating. Isolating the sample loop comprises, and some more detail, and we see this later on. Decreasing the volume of the metering device. Well, there's a subparagraph on that, and then in the disputed subparagraph, wherein decreasing the volume includes, and more specific detail. So by virtue of laying out these steps, getting progressively narrower and adding more to them, and referencing back to the antecedent basis, it makes sense grammatically that we refer to the determined movement in this disputed claim and are simply doing that to refer to the movement that we talked about earlier, but not to suggest any kind of sequence. And the ED at the end of determined, well, we see that in this step while the sample loop is isolated, ED. Initially, it's isolating is the verb tense use. Well, okay, now that we've introduced it, and we're referring back to that same thing, we're gonna use the past tense. But if we're talking about when it happens, it would be express. And so we disagree with Dionex that that entire clause is superfluous. It not only ties together all of the prior background and foundation that's been established in the preceding subparagraphs, but it is the first time that we're actively claiming the step of moving the piston. We're saying forwarding the piston. We talk about a direction, and we're doing it here in this step from the first position to the second position. And if we want to parse it a little further, did we have to say the determined amount and from the first position to the second position? Both of those terms were introduced earlier. Did we have to repeat them? Well, thorough respect for antecedent basis. But what I think is important here is even adopting Dionex's construction, right? Their construction would say, we need to pre-calculate, and that's the only way that this claim makes any sense. That doesn't resolve this alleged redundancy and superfluousness problem that they're talking about. We still have this reference to determined amount and from the first to the second. So the argument about redundancy doesn't trump here, especially when we look at the result that comes out of this and the fact that what Dionex is doing is saying, well, make this rule about redundancy trump the fact that this is the only embodiment in the Agilent specification. So we certainly should be construing the claim in light of the specification. And they're saying, well, you could have wordsmithed this a little better. I think virtually every method claim, you could go back with a red pen and maybe reduce the word count a little bit. But the general rule isn't that being able to do that means imply a sequence. The general rule is no sequence unless we specifically see it. And I want to respond to a point that Mr. Risbester raised, which is that it was described differently in their specification. When they talked about the real-time embodiment, I believe he said that it was described in a different way, and actually I think it's quite instructive the way they described it. It's very consistent with our approach. So even if we are applying the Dionex specification, and I'll get to why that may not make sense under the Agilent rule, but even under their specification, if we look in the second appendix at the sentence that spans from pages 2682 to 2683, they're summarizing, okay, we've got these two approaches. We can calculate the amount of travel that they refer to, the movement they call travel. We can calculate it, or they can do the real-time embodiment, and here's what they say. Or that amount of travel, quote, or can be, quote, or determined by measuring and controlling the pressure. So they use the determined word themselves to describe the active step of the real-time monitoring, and they mix determined with measuring and controlling. So these verb tenses don't resolve things, and it makes, again, much more sense to read the claim consistent with our approach that determining includes real-time. We don't think it changes the outcome here as far as what was the source of this claim and which spec should apply. Well, the verbatim claim that is now the count first appeared in Agilent's patent application. The word determine was for the first time showed up in Agilent's patent application. Dionex below acknowledged that determine was first used by Agilent. That's the second appendix at 487. So we made that change, very deliberate change. The Dionex claim said determine. I'm sorry, Dionex claim said calculate. We changed it to determine. And what we don't see is any law from Dionex saying, well, okay, when we apply this Agilent rule to look at whose spec applies, let's go back in the history. Let's go back to parent cases. Let's think about what motivated the claim drafter to put that term in there in the first place. And there isn't any such law. But again, like I say, if it's RSpec, we think their reading is strained because that's the only embodiment and it makes sense to interpret in view of the spec and in view of the one and only disclosed embodiment of RSpec. But even if we're using the Dionic spec, they use the word determined to reference that real-time action, and that's what we're claiming and we think should apply. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, if I may pick up where Mr. Sanger left off, the top of page APPX 2683, where the words determined by measuring and controlling the pressure appear in the Dionic specification. This is the alternative embodiment that Judge Stark and I discussed. What is happening there is the pressure on the sample loop is being measured, and that is determining. You are increasing the pressure in the sample loop, and you are measuring the pressure. And when it is equal, then you have achieved that full precompression. So there is a measurement component to determining. In the feedback loop approach, the only measuring that is done is of the pressure in the sample loop. That's not what the count is directed to. That's not what Agilent's claim is directed to. Agilent's claim is directed to determining the movement amount. And there is nothing in the Dionics feedback mechanism in which Dionics describes determining the movement amount. That's part of the algorithm approach where you calculate how much you need to advance the piston in order to achieve the pressure you're looking for. So we actually think that language in the Dionics specification enhances our claim construction position. When a person of skill in the art is referring to actually measuring something, they can use the word determining. When it's not being measured, such as in the Agilent specification, the travel or the movement amount of the piston, which is never measured, never recorded, nobody knows how much it did move, you don't use the word determining. I also think that there is a parallelism in the claim language between the progressive isolating, determining, and then the past participle isolated and determined. The first step in the Agilent claim is isolating the sample loop. Thereafter, it is the isolated sample loop. It has already happened, and therefore the sample loop is isolated. Similarly, there is a step for determining the movement amount. Thereafter, it's the determined movement amount. So I think we can move past whether or not this case revolves around the word the to whether it revolves around the two letters ED. But they are significant, and there is parallelism in the claims that exactly shows that there is a sequentiality intended by the use of isolating, isolated, determining, determined. Mr. Skanga, my friend revisited some priority questions, and in particular, he noted that the Agilent witnesses provided additional declarations in the 2372 case, and Dionics declined to take their depositions. Why did that happen? Mr. Skanga argues, well, it's because the evidence is already so replete. But what we had was sworn testimony what we had was sworn testimony from Mr. Bowerly that he did not know the hydraulic details of the prototype. He had never seen the modified pump. He had never seen the modified valve. We have sworn testimony from Mr. Bowerly that he'd seen a pressure plot on the column side, but he'd never seen a plot of the pressure on the sample loop side. And we had sworn testimony from Mr. Kretz that 2152 included make before break in addition to some form of pre-compression. And we had Mr. Bowerly testifying in deposition that make before break allowed for equalization of the pressure in the sample loop to the pressure on the column side. So what was there left to take a deposition about? Finally, I'd like to address the alternative grounds. And I'm not quite sure whether we're speaking here about simply the 2372 case or 1794 as well. If we're speaking to 1794, I'd like to point out that even if the argument is successful and claim 25 should have been found unpatentable by virtue of interference estoppel, that still left all of the dependent claims. The most that this court could do is remand back to the board for consideration of the dependent claims, which was never presented to the board by Agilent in the first instance. And with respect to 2372, what the board did was say, you haven't met your burden of creating a prima facie case of obviousness with respect to the Dionex claims over the loss count. So we're not even going to get to Dionex's response. Again, the most this court could do, unless it wishes to become a court of first instance, is remand to the board for further proceedings. And that being the relief, a cross appeal would have been necessary. If the court has no further questions, we rest. We thank you for your time.
Okay, we thank all the parties for their arguments this morning. That concludes the arguments of today. This court now stands in recess.